Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck, Americans? What's happening? What is happening, America? God damn it. What a relief that was yesterday. I'm surprised I get so choked up about it, but I do anyways. The ceremony, the pomp and circumstance, the orderly transition of power in the middle of 30,000 National Guardsmen. But look, it's done. New management is here. The conspiracy theories were wrong. Not only wrong, but it seems like some of the creators of some of the bigger conspiracies were basically like, ah, we were just kidding. Huh? Pretty funny, right? We used your gullibility to break the world. You get it, right? Hilarious, right? The internet's amazing. It's awesome. All right, good luck. It's still going to fascinate me for the rest of time how so many people just couldn't wrap their brain around how one of the biggest assholes that's ever lived, publicly or privately, was unpopular enough to lose the presidential election. That a majority of people wanted new management, wanted stability, wanted the government to function again, wanted to be able to look at their neighbors again, to feel like they could believe in people again. I'll tell you, one of the dark gifts of this last 4 years is we know who we all are. I know who I am. I know who my neighbors are. I know who my parents are and friends of the family. We know who everybody, everything's on the table. All the garbage is floated to the top and some of the cream. But what a celebration it was yesterday in terms of embracing diversity, embracing people of all types, and just bringing back some sort of stability, man. It's really stability and the belief that something will be taken care of in a reasonable way, in a righteous way, in a respectful way, and that the person at the helm is a guy who understands how to do the job, how to do the work, how it works. And he's a humble dude, that Biden. I'll tell you, that speech was one of the best inaugural speeches I've heard. And I felt like he held the weight of the world on his shoulders in a respectable and decent way. He's a guy with some real humility, some real wisdom. He's got age on his side. But, you know, he's a humble guy with a deep heart and understands grief. And this fucking country is soaking in it. Soaking in fucking grief. He happens to be the right guy for the job at this time. Kamala was great. Everybody was great. I even got nostalgic and in an angry way, seeing like W waddle down those stairs, that recognizable waddle. It's interesting how well you get to know the people that you have the most resentment towards, especially public figures. When you're given the opportunity to hate somebody deeply every day, you really understand them. They really make a fucking scar in your brain. They're really up there forever. So are the people you love, but it's interesting, the type of energy that is sort of regrooved and relit when you see somebody you haven't seen in a while who you resent deeply, maybe even righteously. But I thought the inauguration went great. I really do. the peaceful transition of power behind a wall of tens of thousands of National Guardsmen. Before I get too far into whatever I'm going to be doing, my guest today is Andy Zaltzman. I first met him in the UK back in 2007. He's a comedian. He just started up the podcast, The Bugle with John Oliver, which he still hosts, along with the news quiz on BBC Radio 4. He was a good guy. I was out of my mind with sadness and fucking chaos because I'd been left by my second wife, and I went to Scotland. Not a great time. But that's coming up. Man, so it's relieving that we're not going to be kind of brutalized and terrorized on a daily basis by a autocratic pig of a person, by a mean sociopathic leader, that we're not going to have to deal with that every morning waking up. Look, people love that guy, assholes, a lot of them, or just people who are so rich they don't give a fuck about people. But the truth of the matter is, he was an abusive piece of shit. And he was throwing that shit at us every day. And those of us who felt that deeply, and those of us who he terrorized daily, feel relieved because a majority of people are us. A big majority of people are the people that saw that guy for the asshole that he was all the way through, and could not understand or believe why he was president, and then had to deal with that fear every day from day fucking one. Just being abused and terrorized by a guy who enjoyed it. He enjoyed being hated by people. He enjoyed any kind of attention he got. But he loved fucking making people hate him and making the people that didn't like him angry and scared. He created a tone for this country that was just horrible. The neediness of that evil fuck that we had to deal with for 4 years was debilitating, draining, dangerous, deadly. The lack of responsibility, debilitating, draining, deadly. And now that's over. We get a little relief. Look, man, I'm not saying that everything's okay or that the monsters are going to go away or that even things are resolved. We've got big fucking problems. All I know is that one plague down, now we got to get rid of this other plague. So now we move on, and it's no less scary. I want to get vaccinated. I want to get through this. I want people to bounce back. I'm not optimistic. I'm not even that hopeful necessarily. I'm just relieved, and I feel a little safer on a country level in terms of the possibility for stability, and that we're all not just reacting to or becoming symbiotic with a malignant, narcissistic autocrat who is able, through charisma and propaganda and repetition, to really brain fuck a lot of people into following him, but also into being terrified on a day-to-day basis of him and what he represented. So now with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, president and vice president, maybe we can stabilize this fucking undertaking, get everybody vaccinated, and try to rebuild a little bit. I don't know. I'm relieved today. I really am. Whew. So Andy Zaltzman, he's in the UK, or he was a couple weeks ago. This happened before the inauguration. As I said earlier, I met him back in 2007. He's got the podcast, The Bugle, and he's also on the news quiz on BBC Radio 4. And this is a nice conversation I had with Andy Zaltzman. What's up, pal?
Nice to see you. It's been a while.
It's been a very long time.
Yeah.
I saw the last time I saw you, could it be the only time I saw you?
Well, we did stuff together in Edinburgh that
right. It was a terrible
2006,
time.
2006, was it?
Yeah.
It was a long time ago. Pre-podcasts, Mark, I think.
It was a terrible time for me, as I recall.
Yeah, it's not entirely my fault.
It had nothing to do with you. Okay, you were very nice.
All right.
You gave me a spot on your show. You were pleasant. But it was my first time at the festival, and I vowed never to go back there again. And I haven't.
You've kept that vow. It's good. There's very few vows in this world that people keep these days, Mark. So I'm having the courage to stick with that.
I just didn't understand the whole system. It's a system that you guys, live with over there and that you guys understand. For me, it was just embarrassing and horrendous. And it was desperate and sad. And I'd just gotten separated from my wife and I was heartbroken and I was on a double bill and I didn't realize that was a shitty idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, those are certain sort of factors involved, and probably, immediately post breakup is not the ideal time to do an Edinburgh Fest. Well, people make award-winning shows out of breakups these days. It's something I've never quite managed to create in my personal life.
But are you still married?
I'm still married, yeah, which has held back my creative side in a massive amount, sadly.
So the breakup show can still happen. There's always time.
Maybe we'll wait till the kids are left home, just for the...
There you go. Yeah. Then it's got an extra added edge. It's like, I can't believe I put up with it this long. So, but the whole Edinburgh process, I mean, you go back there every year. Right?
Most years, obviously, 2020 was not a great year for Edinburgh, obvious reasons.
It's a bust for everybody, yeah.
It was. So you're one of my most profitable Edinburghs financially, I think.
Year you didn't go. I was actually able to make money at home.
I went for the first time doing new act competitions in 1999. A four-handed show in 2000 that was it was pretty catastrophic, and I learned a lot about the art of negotiating silence and hostility, which is a key part of stand-up. And then I did my first solo show the following year in 2001.
But the other part of it you learned in Edinburgh is that the silence and hostility, but no one being there. I mean, the silence, it's not because your jokes aren't going well. It's because you had to drag two people in off the street who don't know where they're going to sit there and validate your fucking job choice.
Well, it can be both of those things, Mark. It can be two people not laughing. So, you can combine them. But the first year I did a solo show, that ended up going reasonably well within the context of a show that averaged about 14 people. The very first night, I had one ticket sale, and it later turned out that the person who bought the ticket was another comedian who I'd done a gig with a few months before. So,
being a good guy, helping you out.
So it was onwards and very, very slowly upwards.
But the whole process of it there, I have some questions about Britain in general, because I always assume that you guys have it all together and that you're ultimately a better culture than us, and that somehow you think you're all smarter than we are.
Right.
And but I don't know if that's true or not. But I do. The system there is that ultimately you have to build an audience at these festivals to make your yearly money, correct? I mean, there's not a huge touring business there, is there?
I think that's changed over the years now. And it was a sort of stand-up boom, I guess, early to midway through the first decade of this millennium, which isn't going great as millenniums go.
Might be the last one.
Could be. Anyway,
we're not going to make it very far into this one. I don't think we're going
to. Yeah, that's a nice optimistic note to kick off with. But I think it did change a bit. So I started out, like I said, around about sort of 99, 2000, and then there were. So there was a TV boom in stand-up, and that's a TV boom that I managed to successfully avoid. But it did make sort of
good for you, good
individual
plan.
Solo touring more viable.
Right?
Yeah. So a lot of comedians will sort of go around. There's not necessarily the most glamorous. It's not all stadium tours.
No, I know. I know what the one-nighter thing is, but it always seemed to me that the slog of the festivals is. You keep going back until somehow or another you know, the plan is to build enough of an audience that, you know, when you go back there, you're one of the big tickets and you can walk away with, you know, thousands of dollars. You know, that's the big reward of slogging through that thing every year and going through the embarrassment and the struggle of a month in that tourist yes. town.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there are positive sides to Edinburgh, and I've always loved doing it for the, you know, just the creative side of it, and I've never been particularly good at the sort of career side of things, but it, you know, it can clearly help you evolve as a, in terms of your sales. But I think creatively, and certainly for the comedians of my generation, it was where we went to sort of learn the art and the craft of stand-up, because you could sort of go around the circuit doing your 5-minute, 10-minute, 20-minute spots in some not always particularly helpful environments. But in Edinburgh, you could have your own hour, and you know, I think that's where you sort of work out what you want to be as a comedian.
Oh, that's interesting. So in lieu of headlining, per se,
yeah.
on
yes.
the road, that, you know, you go there for a month and you do the hour.
Yes, yeah. So the first year I did it, 2001, I was, you know, struggling to get much paid work on the circuit. And, you know, for
what was your particular struggle, Andy? Why didn't people want the Saltzman?
Well, I've made back to that silence that we talked about before. I think as a circuit comedian, Mark, I was hit and miss. There was an inconsistency to my game. I struck out a lot in baseball parlance and got the odd home run, but probably, you know, the stats weren't maybe good enough for a, you know, you want a reliable hitter in those kind of gigs.
I'm still inconsistent, and I pride myself on that. I've spun that into a positive. It's like that's what makes me an artist, is my inconsistency.
Yes, I guess that's a good way of looking at it. But I think I learned fairly early on that, you know, it probably wasn't going to be my long-term career doing club stand. It wasn't something I was particularly good at. And that, you know, the feeling was entirely mutual between me and the club circuit, who didn't give me many bookings. So going to Edinburgh, then you have this sort of blank canvas, and you can be, yeah, you can sort of set it up how you want. You're not following a different comedian who might be a lot better than you or a lot different to you. And it's certainly where I guess found out the type of comedy that I wanted to do.
Also, there's the idea that it's a theater piece now. It's not managing a bunch of drunks at 11:30 at night. We're all going to sit here for an hour, and this thing is going to come together somehow. Perhaps may not be funny, but it'll be thoughtful. And I've bought myself a little time.
Yes, I mean, ideally, it'll be both funny and thoughtful. But and I think it was creatively, you know, inspiring in a lot of ways, and, you know, going to see your peers and seeing how they would do. We're doing, you know, expanding in the same way.
Who were the guys when you were coming up? Like, because, like, I don't know a lot. Like, who's your generation of British comics? That I know you worked with John Oliver forever, and, you know, you guys are pals. And I love John a lot. And he's, you know, he's kept me sane lately. do you guys talk often? Does he keep you sane?
Well, we don't talk as often as we used to. You know, talk every week and record it and put it out as a podcast. But since John stopped doing that, which is, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago now, I see him whenever I go to New York, which, the current global situation isn't looking like it's going to be very soon again. And, you know, we sort of chat every now and then. He did the Bugle for the first time since he left the show just before Christmas. So that was, we got the old band back together
How was that?
Show.
Fun, right?
It was great, actually. It was it was a lot of fun, and it was we sort of met doing the live stand up circuit, and he did little sketches in my first Edinburgh show. I did some stuff in his first Edinburgh show the following year, 2002. We toured on the student union circuit, which is again a sort of part of, you know, my generation of British comedians. There was quite a thriving student union circuit where you could go and experiment, and it didn't matter so much.
But that was better than clubs, right?
It was better than clubs, partly because generally, you know, you were booked in to do a whole tour, so it wasn't like you had to succeed at every gig to get called back. So we got to know each other pretty well. Then we did some radio series together. Then when John got the Daily Show job and left me doing an Edinburgh show alone instead of a two-hander in front of about 25 people a night, obviously went to the biggest comedy show in the world.
How'd that go for you? How'd you take that?
Well, I'll be honest, it was a bit tricky at the time. He got offered the Daily Show job just before... It was about a month before Edinburgh started. And so, we had... An exaggeration to say I had to rewrite the show because we hadn't entirely got around to starting writing it at that point.
That must have been a horrible, horrible conversation.
Well, not really, because, clearly a pretty big opportunity. So
I know, but still, you had to suck it up.
I guess so. And we'd also had two BBC radio series cancelled around about the same time. And I found out my wife was pregnant. So it was a month of considerable upheaval for me.
Did you do a show about having a baby?
No, I've never. I did a routine. My second child I delivered in the bathroom at
home. You did?
I did, yes.
That was, on purpose?
No, definitely not on purpose. I think it might have been an early prank by my 0 minute old son, things happened a little too fast, and I ended up having a brief but very statistically successful midwifery career.
Did you know what you were doing?
Absolutely not. I mean, I've managed to avoid picking up practical skills throughout my life.
But that was, I don't think everyone has that practical skill. It's not something you no, plan for. It's not in the book of.
It's
you know,
innate,
like home
isn't it?
Repair.
It's a midwifery. It's one of those, you've either got it or you haven't. It was terrifying, but fortunately it was a fairly straightforward. But I was on a phone call to the emergency services.
Oh, my God. Did you have to cut the umbilical cord and everything?
Didn't have to cut the cord, sadly. There was an ambulance on the way, so they sort of dealt with They stepped in and they did the...
Oh, my God.
They closed it out, but I was... it was I went to a British private school they specifically designed to leave you with absolutely no practical life skills. So when I found myself in that situation, there was nothing in my life that had given me
no,
what I needed.
Yeah, that's something that people take care of for you.
Exactly.
Yeah. You go to the place and they do it.
Yeah.
You know, out of the view of others.
Exactly. Yeah.
How did you grew up in London?
I grew up just south of London in a town called Tunbridge Wells, which is a sort of commuter belt conservative town that's sort of perfectly pleasant but not wildly exciting.
What did your parents do?
My father was a sculptor.
Really? Like yes. A successful sculptor?
It depends how you define success, Mark. Artistically, I would say yes. And commercially, not as successful.
Misunderstood? Is he misunderstood?
I don't know. He set an example that, in terms of a career role model, that it wasn't necessary to get what you might call a proper job. So when I started thinking about doing stand-up, he couldn't turn around to me and say, what are you doing with your life? Because he'd spent the last 25 years in a barn with a load of wax and plaster. They were a real mixture in fact, you can see it on the zoo just up behind me there.
He did not abstract either. Those are, figures. That's a male.
Figurative. He went through all kinds of different styles. But and so we grew up surrounded by his.
And you got that in the basement? Is that where you are?
I have a sort of office shed in the garden.
So that's where you hide the sculpture. That's not something you put in the living room.
No, we've got some in the living room as well. So, well, they just moved house, and we had to clear out. His studio, and so there was rather.
Is he not around anymore?
No, he's still around, but he's not really sculpting anymore. But we sort of picked up a consignment of artworks, so now our house has become something of a Zach Zaltzman art gallery.
Zach Zaltzman. So you grew up going to openings, looking at new pieces.
There weren't that many openings, but we used to go and see his studio, and he would sort of disappear off every day, and every now and again would bring home something. But it's set a creative example.
Did your mother work for a living? I mean, who was?
Well, she had been a radiographer, and then
X-ray tech? What's a radiographer?
Yes, yeah. Okay. As was, I guess, generally the way when she had three children, which she just sort of looked after us, and then subsequently became a teacher in her sort of mid to late 40s and taught for sort of 15, 20 years. So, so quite different people, really.
And you brought up Jewish?
Well, sort of. My father was from a Jewish family, grew up in South Africa, his parents were Lithuanian Jews, essentially.
That ran away to South Africa?
In the early 20th century. I think my grandfather went to South Africa in about 1920. My dad was born there, then moved to England, married my mother. His Jewish parents were not entirely delighted that he'd married a Gentile. My mother then converted and they remarried. So they got married twice without getting divorced. So then my mother became Jewish so that their children would be. So we weren't really brought up strictly Jewish. I guess the most Jewish I've probably ever felt was 8 days old.
That's when it happens.
Still got the receipt for that. But we didn't grow up in a Jewish community or anything, and we didn't go to Jewish schools. But my brother and I were bar mitzvahed, and we used to go and have Hebrew lessons, to teach us to read our bits of the Torah that we were going to need for our bar mitzvahs.
Of course, and not understand them.
Absolutely not. Didn't know what it meant, we knew how technically to.
Yeah, you had to sing them. Yeah, to get the weird rhythm of the Haftorah and get through it.
Yeah.
So that's interesting because, like, I was hoping to glean something about British Jewish culture because for some reason I have this weird obsessive fascination with British Jews. And I just wonder, you know, what they eat and, you know, how they communicate with each other in relation to, like, you know, kind of Ashkenazi American middle class Jews. Like, is there a similarity? You know, I don't talk to many British Jews.
I can't really help you with that.
I know, man.
Yeah, we've...
Well, did you have a bar mitzvah party?
I did have a bar mitzvah party. It was the day after one of the largest hurricanes that's ever hit the British Isles. And so we almost couldn't get to the synagogue. We had to drive about 40 miles to the nearest synagogue. I ended up with one trumpet up and a big book about cricket. That's largely what I remember about it.
And a few bonds? No bonds?
No, I don't think so. No, it was
no cash.
A little bit of cash, but not a life changing. I mean, I guess not a life changing amount of cash. But
you went to a private school?
Yes. Yes.
And what is that? So, did you go to you went to one of the fancy colleges?
Well, it was, I guess it was sort of traditional English private school. I didn't, most of the pupils were boarders. It was an all-boys school, but I was a day pupil, so my father would drive me in every morning.
Oh, so some of them would sleep there?
Yeah.
You had to wear the blazer?
Yes, a nice sort of tweedy jacket. Very sort of, you know, traditional... kind of British education, it was good in some ways, but less good in others. There were huge gaps in my
practical stuff.
Never met a girl when I left school. couldn't rewire a plug. Didn't know how to change a tire on a car, but I could express all that in grammatically perfect Latin. So it was, you know, there were good points and bad points, I guess.
You learned Latin?
Yes, yeah, I did Latin and ancient Greek, just in case. Things always make a comeback.
You had to? Was it like part of the...
I can't remember if it was compulsory, but I really liked it, and I ended up studying it at university, as did my wife, and that's how we met. So Latin basically found me a life partner. So,
what was it about Latin, do you think?
I don't know. I guess there's a sort of fascination in the civilization that grew and flourished and then faded. And the same with the ancient Greeks. Always sort of preferred the ancient Greek side of my studies. And it was a fascinating sort of studying a completed civilization. And particularly when you think of the upheavals that America has been going through of late, and there are certain patterns that that obviously recur through history as civilizations rise and fall. So
is this where you tell me I got to leave?
I'm not sure exactly what point of the. I don't know if the Visigoths are at the gate yet.
Close. They're at the capital. They were yesterday.
I think the Visigoths are a bit more organized than that.
Yeah, thank God. That's the one blessing is they had no idea what they were there. Once they got in, they didn't know what to do other than take pictures and ruin things.
Yes, and try and steal a lectern.
That guy. So, but so that you had a sort of fascination with the coming fading of empire or the
which is as a Brit growing up in the late 20th century was probably quite a useful thing to have. And I also studied ancient Greek comedy, which was absolutely fascinating.
Like Aeschylus?
He was tragic. Aristophanes was the main...
Aristophanes, right. The clouds, right?
Yes, yeah. And
Didn't one of those open with, like, a farting contest?
There's a lot of farting in it. And it was... Because it was performed to sort of all layers of society, it operates on a huge number of levels comedically. There's fart jokes, there's sex jokes, and there's literary parody and political satire all kind of wadged into one. And it was absolutely fascinating. I was with my wife on holiday in Greece about 15 years ago, and there was a production of the Aristophanes' Frogs in the ancient Roman theatre on the side of the Acropolis in Athens. In modern Greek, but we happened to have a translation of it with us on holiday because I was doing a radio show about ancient Greece just after that, and I was trying to read up on stuff that I'd forgotten from 15 years ago. So we happened to have a translation. We could sort of follow along with it, and it was really amazing seeing jokes that were almost 2,500 years old still making people laugh, basically, a couple of hundred yards away from where they were first performed in about 400 BC. It was one of the most sort of inspirational comedy watching moments that I've had. It felt like, time had ceased to exist as a concept. People were still laughing at the same stuff, 2,400 years on.
It's inspiring to know that if you structure your act correctly, you never have to change it. Is that if you rely on farts and subliminal sex jokes, you can go for centuries.
Century, and a lot of they were not subliminal. A lot of those sex jokes, they were liminal.
But that is sort of fascinating because, in this day and age, you'd be like, "Well, that's hacky." It's like it's hacky, but there are human truths,
yes,
that have remained embarrassingly funny since the beginning of humans.
Yes, yeah, and I think they will always, I think it's something that is really missing from sci-fi set in, long distant future. There's not enough people still laughing at flatulence.
Well, flatulence is always surprising on a couple of ways. You've got the noise itself. Yeah. You've got the duration of the noise.
Yeah.
But then there's the third one, the smell. So, that's three levels right there.
Yeah, and I don't know how they operate in deep space. Maybe there's the human body works differently, but you would think that's something that sci-fi moving forward.
Oh, sure. In the right stuff, you got a guy peeing in a spacesuit. I've not seen flatulence explored. the inability to get away from your own flatulence in the suit.
Yeah,
and maybe that causes deaths. Maybe that's it. An entire ship of guys in suits get some food poisoning and they all die, and it's a tremendous mystery for floating around in space for centuries.
Right. I mean, it sounds like we're workshopping a film pitch here, Mark.
We are, right. And the punchline is, oh my God, they shit in their suits.
There we go. It's high culture.
Ended up with a degree in ancient Greece and Latin?
Yeah.
From what college?
Well, I was at University College in Oxford.
Is that the Oxford? Oxford?
Yeah. So I left with this degree, but no real idea what I wanted to do in life.
But the education, right? See, this is like I want to demystify. Yeah. Like, you know, recently, as time goes on, you know, Harvard is completely demystified. They make monsters there, and they don't necessarily, you know, it's careerism. But there is some good things about it. But there is a type of ambition that is nurtured there that I've seen in show business that is disconcerting. Now, I'm not saying that you can't get a good education at Harvard. I'm just saying that, you know, they've created fascists and very popular comedy writers. So, but I mean, the question about Oxford is, I guess, who did I talk to? Was it Sacha Baron Cohen? Was he an Oxford graduate?
I can't remember if he was Oxford or Cambridge. Oliver went to Cambridge.
Okay, and the difference between the two is what? They're in different towns, or
nothing much. One's light blue, one's dark blue. I don't know if that's the color of people's blood or what, but there's not a great deal of difference. I don't know.
And the structure of the education, like, were you able to, like, you well rounded intellectually? You seem
I don't know if well rounded is the right description. I mean, it is, you know, it's a fascinating place, but yeah, there's particularly doing the type of study I did, it's not got huge applications to the real world, but I had a great time there. And
but what is the real world? I mean, the real world is like, I mean, you like to think, you're a thinker, you're a guy who looks at the world and processes it politically and philosophically and socially, and you comment on it. I would imagine that the education you got was perfect for that.
I guess so, yes. And, you know, like I said, I ended up, you know, doing comedy, which I slightly studied as part of my ancient Greek side of things.
What was the other option? I mean, how did you arrive at that?
Well, that was part of the literature course. So it was the ancient Greek literature was, well, the tragedies and epic poetry, the Homer, and studying the sort of foundations of European civilization.
But how did you decide to do comedy?
Like, well, I think I'm just because I was just interested by it, and I'd done a little bit of it at school, and it was just struck me as being an interesting thing to study. You know, how did comedy work in a completely different ancient dead civilization? And I think, you know, it shows a lot. You know, a society's comedy tells you a lot about that society in a way that, say, studying the tragedies, which were sort of less topical and more sort of universal, didn't necessarily give you an idea of what it would have been like to be an ancient Athenian. Whereas when you think the comedy is aiming at making the people watching it at the time laugh, and so you can then start to understand people's sense of humor, and therefore you can almost build up a picture of what life would have been like, how people would have talked to each other, how they would have tried to make each other laugh. So I guess there's certain sort of timeless universalities about that that were rather fascinating.
But what comic? When did you realize, like, I can do that? When did you see a stand up?
My first ever gig was very drunk, and B, it was a comedy night while I was a student at Oxford. In our college, and a friend had organised it, and the headline act rang up half an hour before saying he couldn't make it, and I was just going to sort of introduce it and do a couple of bits in between, and so I had to sort of try and fill a bit more time, and the support act did a longer set, and I had about half an hour's notice of this, and I got very drunk and can't remember anything that I said, but I remember the sort of surge of adrenaline of doing it, which, you know, is one of the addictive things about stand up. And so
you remember for 30 seconds, I didn't feel as drunk as I was.
Exactly, and I didn't. I've never been a particular drinker, but it was, you know, I guess the nerves and the tension. So that was, I guess, my first attempt at stand up. I then had a few gigs when I left university that went so badly that I gave up for about a year and a half.
Well, what was the other option for work for you? Like, you know, if it wasn't stand-up, what were you headed towards? Teaching?
Well, I don't know. I sort of had a vague idea that I wanted to be a journalist, and particularly a sports journalist. And left university, applied for about 80 jobs, ended up getting a job sub-editing articles about European finance, which was slightly less exciting than it sounds, Mark.
Riveting. I'm surprised.
Lasted about a year, then just gave up and started doing the open mic circuit in London.
And who was around? Who are the guys that, you know, like that you started with that are still around?
Well, I mean, John was starting out around about the same time. Russell Howard was starting around then. Uh-huh. Jimmy Carr, people who've been very successful here. Daniel Kitson was sort of the big, the most successful kind of comedian of my generation creatively here. And he was, I think, someone that, you know, everyone of my generation on the circuit sort of looked up to. He was, starting.
Yeah. I mean, I knew, I heard about Kitson for years, and I think I saw one big show of his in London. I know he's a unique person.
Yeah.
Doesn't do the podcast or talk or, you know, function necessarily in a sociable way. But I've met him a few times, and I know that he's revered.
Yes.
So he was of your generation or a little ahead of you,
Well, he'd started a bit before me. I mean, there were, in terms of sort of gigs that were kind of landmarks in my early stand-up career. There was one in particular. I went to see Robert Newman, who'd been a huge TV star in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Various shows. But he'd become a kind of crusading, almost journalistic stand-up. And he did an hour and a half in Edinburgh, largely about the perils of capitalism and globalization, and it was just hugely eye-opening that someone had the courage to do that, and the skills to make it interesting, the charisma to carry it off. And that was while I was up doing my that package show I mentioned in Edinburgh, my first sort of full Edinburgh one. I was really struggling doing a late night gig, and I didn't really have the skills for it. I'd only been going 18 months or so on the circuit, and there was a lot of things that I couldn't do. And I was becoming increasingly dissatisfied with the material I was doing. And seeing Robert Newman do such a fearless, uncompromising show made me think, well, maybe I need to not keep worrying about what is going to make the audience laugh, and think more why am I doing this, and what do I want to...
And that is the moment that we of inconsistent means all have... That powerful moment of enlightenment that dictates our struggle for the rest of our lives.
Exactly.
I don't need to make them laugh as long as I'm smart and blow their mind.
And that's why I'm sitting in a shed in South London as we speak.
Yeah, that's it, man. So what about Stuart Lee?
Well, I mean, that was another... important gig for me. That was one I supported him at a charity night, and I'd seen him on television. I'd never seen him doing live stand up, and it was the lineup was Stuart Lee headlining, me as a support act, and after us was DJ Randy Groover, who was a DJ in a spangly jacket playing some absolutely banging.
And please tell me most people were there to see him.
I think I can't really remember. Stuart Lee wasn't. I mean, he was quite well known, but he hadn't become the
Was this before he quit and then come back?
I think he was just on the way back at that point.
Oh,
from memory. And then I did a few gigs supporting him on tour when he was briefly on a diet where he ate nothing but cabbage soup and had.
I remember that diet.
Come on the
train. Was he fat?
I think he had been. I don't know how much good it did him, but he didn't seem to be enjoying it very much. But it was, as a new stand-up, getting to support him on at a few gigs, and travel around.
Was he able to integrate flatulence into his show?
I think he's always had that. He's always had that club in his bag. I did some get my first. The year I did my first solo show in Edinburgh in 2001, I ended up doing three gigs supporting Joan Rivers, which was really eye-opening. I don't know quite how she ended up with me as her support act, but to see someone of, I can't remember how old she was, she must have been about 70 at the time, with just
must
the
have been great.
Enthusiasm and energy that she had, and the sort of just the love for performing, that was... I mean, she was incredible.
How did she do?
She had quite a big fan base in. I can't remember. It was a sort of 1,500 seat theatre, and they were very. Me doing 7 minutes at the start to 1,500 Joan Rivers fans was not necessarily a recipe for success, but she was.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
She was incredible. So, yeah, physical energy and the speed of her mind as well. That was really great to see as a new stand-up, to see someone who'd been doing it since literally before I was born.
And were you, like, I don't know how old you are in compared to me. How old are you?
I'm 46.
Oh, you're younger than me.
Right, yeah.
So you don't remember necessarily, or you were not comedically cognizant when Bill Hicks landed in your country?
No, I missed that. I think if I'd been more into comedy than I was as a student, I could have seen him. Nick Doody, who was another comedian, I don't know if you know Nick from the British circuit. I mean, he ended up supporting Bill Hicks at a gig as a student in Oxford.
Well, it seems to me that for some comics, and certainly maybe for somebody like you, his arrival was sort of like, Hendrix, to the musicians of London when he came over.
You know,
there seemed to be an impact being made.
Well, that was a bit before my time, sadly. So I sort of slightly missed out on that.
But I think there's a legacy of guys we're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, like when I saw Stuart Lee, like I'd been hearing about him for a long time, and I just don't know a lot about British comedy, but when I went to Edinburgh and I saw him. That he's one of those guys that decides the pace.
Yes.
I've always admired people that sort of like, this is going to be difficult for a lot of you, but this is what's going to happen. And this is the speed at which it will happen. And this is the tone of it.
Yes.
So make your decisions. Are you in or out?
Yes.
And, it's a rare thing. It's a great thing.
Yes. And it's, I guess, at some point, all comedians have to decide if, how, and where they will or will not compromise. And
it's a weird thing.
Yeah.
You're gifted if you have no choice, in a weird way. Like if this is all you got, this is me, I got no other gear. there's no like, I better do this to make this work better.
Yes.
That's a gift. It's a painful gift. But it's a gift.
Yeah, but it's a liberating realization, isn't it? So, again, in one of my first Edinburghs, I went to see Tim Vine, who does nothing but puns. And,
I remember that guy.
But he has absolutely no plan B. And clearly not everyone likes plan A. But he just, he is,
that's it.
In his own way, totally uncompromising as well. And I think that's what I got out of most in my first 2 or 3 years doing Edinburgh, was seeing, other comedians who are sort of further on in the process and how they were choosing to do their comedy.
Dug into their character.
Yeah.
I'm going to do something I haven't done before, but I think it'll make the conversation better. You're going to excuse me for a second so I can go to the restroom. Is that all right?
Yeah, fine.
Don't go away.
Okay.
It's very interesting to me, because I'm talking to you and you're British, that I actually excused myself. Generally, it would be like, I got to pee, hang out a minute. But no, yeah. I'd like to be excused for a second. I have to use the restroom. What the fuck is wrong with me?
That's the effect. You can't, you might have jumped ship in 1776, but you can never fully get rid of us. In fact, you might be with Brexit. We're open for business again. Come back to the mothership, America.
Get me up to speed. So you're in lockdown right now.
Yes.
Big time, right?
Big time lockdown.
Because there's a new exciting strain.
Yes.
That permeates walls.
It permeates everything. It's a British strain, therefore it's easily the best. It's a world-leading virus strain. Once again, we're ahead of the world.
Good, finally back. They're back.
Yes. So we're sitting at home, and
Yes. Did you, were you able to go out for a little while? I mean, I don't know what you guys are going through. It's pretty, like, it's so scary here. Do you know people that have gotten it? Are you?
I know a few people who've had it, and I mean, luckily no one close to me has been severely ill with it.
Yeah.
But obviously it's been a massive disruption on my children's schooling. They're 14 and 12, and it's, you know, it's tough. They're having to, you know, sit at home, do just basically working off computers, and which is, you know, that it's a huge scar on a whole sort of generation's childhoods. So I'm not sure we know the full repercussions of it. You know, luckily we've got a nice house and a bit of space and parks nearby, and so, you know, it's much better for
and
us.
You guys going
people,
crazy, but... are you getting closer, are you learning things about each other you never wanted to?
So we've got on pretty well, considering. Watched a lot of television, and yeah, you know, I was during the summer last year. I in my sort of parallel life to comedy, I'm a cricket statistician, and I do cricket stats on the radio for the BBC cricket coverage. So I got to go and spend 6 weeks watching international sport during the middle of lockdown, which was one of the weirdest, most surreal experiences of my life.
Huh.
So,
but it's nice that like it is, you are grateful to be working.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the one thing about doing what we do and figuring out how to adapt is that, I mean, you do a weekly radio show now, correct?
Yeah, I do a radio show for BBC Radio 4 called The News Quiz, which is a sort of topical show that's on sort of half sort of 24 weeks a year. And I still do the Bugle podcast with sort of rotating cast of co-hosts since John left. So
is that every week?
That's every week. So
it's nice to be working. Imagine if we weren't working, it'd be crazy.
So, and you know, for people who, you know, whose main line of work and income is stand-up, this has been completely catastrophic. So, I've been
terrible.
Very fortunate from that point of view. But the last performance I did in front of live, actual, physical human beings was, I think, almost a year ago now, just at the end of January. And I do think quite a lot about, you know, what will I still be able to do? I don't know if you think that, you know, when you were last on stage with
sadly,
a crowd.
Sadly, my thoughts are, do I still want to? I think I'm I think I'm good. I think.
Well, that's another side
enough.
Of it, isn't it? There's been times when I've thought I really miss it, and there's other times when I thought, well, do I have the strength to go back to it and almost relearn those skills and those?
I think the skills will probably come back and it will probably be exciting. You know, I just don't. I have to assume that things will have to be different after all this shit. I mean, after Brexit, after we become, you know, an authoritarian country, that how we approach, you know, life again it has to be different. I mean, I don't believe that there's some sort of return to something. You know, this is like, we don't know what the fuck is ahead on any level.
No, which is, I guess, simultaneously exciting and terrifying.
Terrifying. It's terrifying some days. Yeah, I mean, I had a trouble sleeping last night. But I don't understand Brexit at all because, like, I can barely keep up with the news here. But, I know that people in the UK look to us as like, you know, what the fuck is happening there? But I have that same thing. I'm like, what is really happening there?
Well, I think most people in Britain are thinking that, probably on both sides of the Brexit divide. And it's, you know, it's been the strange thing with Brexit is Britain's membership of the European Union has been slightly controversial for most of the sort of 4.5 decades that we were part of the EU. But it was never it was never a massive political issue, and all the sort of polls, you know, said it was in the, you know, it was a major issue for about 5% of the people. And then essentially party political reasons, David Cameron, then Prime Minister, you know, called this referendum, and it suddenly became the completely defining totemic political issue of our times. And it's created divisions, I think, of a similar type to the divisions that Trump has created. Well, it's a mixture of sort of creating and revealing, I guess.
Disenfranchised working class, anti-immigration, nationalism on one side?
Well, there's sort of various degrees of that. But I think it's created divisions that are not obviously bridgeable or curable, whatever happens. So, and so in terms of the, you know, the long term prospects, obviously with the difference with Brexit and Trump is that Trump was only going to be president for 4 or 8 years, whereas Brexit is for, you know, the foreseeable future, whether it's forever or not. I don't know. It's impossible to say. But it's not something that can be forced back into the box in the way that Trump has, albeit that there is now debris all around the box and the box may pop open again before collapsing like an overstretched metaphor. So it's become sort of defined politics. And now we're stuck with it, and it's going to be one of those things. Well, philosophically, I was, you know, I was a huge fan of the European Union and Britain being part of it, and you know, I will always think that, and I always hope that Britain returns to being part of either the European Union or whatever may emerge from it, if it collapses or whatever. And in the same way that people who were opposed to it remained opposed to it throughout the 4 decades, which were largely successful for both Europe and Britain, that Britain was a member. So there's no real middle ground. And COVID has almost been a distraction from Brexit. And, the sort of past year when we might have been sort of really kind of introvertedly examining what Brexit meant for Britain as a country and for the people who live in it, we've been completely distracted. So I don't know when we're going to get round to that reckoning and working out exactly who we are and what we want to be.
Right. All this work has been done. The Brexit deal is finalized, but now no one can go outside.
Yes.
And that's all put on hold. Is how culture and British society will function under the new game.
Yes. It's all on. Yes, I mean, we've essentially hibernated as a nation, and in fact, I mean, I think there is something to be said, I think, for hibernation. I think it's something that humans as a species
might consider.
We should consider
taking a 3 month or to a year break.
Yeah, I think, you know, if there is a positive to come out of COVID, I guess lockdown is as close to hibernation as we're generally allowed to get, and you know, it's something that I would like to see formally instituted. 3 months every year.
Sure. I mean, it's sort of like the midday nap in Italy and Spain.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's just like you'll have a 3 month a year nap.
Yes. I mean, that's one of my main reasons for being in favor of Britain staying in the EU, is I've always hoped that Britain would adopt the siesta for, you know, the proper afternoon nap, which is always something that we've been a bit too hardworking as a society. Despite my best efforts to balance that out statistically.
But isn't there certain pub rules? I mean, isn't there an instituted, like, isn't there a midday drink you're supposed to have?
Yes. That was, that's always been part. We've drunk through a lot of things in our history as a society. And, in fact, with COVID, there was so much of the debate was about when and how the pubs would open. That was for a while, that seemed to be the most important thing that the government had to deal with, was managing the reopening of British pubs, which had not even shut down during the Blitz, I think. So this just shows how, you know, what COVID has done. Yeah. That it made British pubs close. And
they are closed, huh?
They are currently closed. They were open. They've been sort of intermittently open. They're now, I think, currently all closed. For a while, you could get takeaway beer from pubs, which slightly defeats the object. I don't know if they're doing takeaway quizzes as well, but yeah.
Are the ICU units like busting like here? I mean, is the death rate spiraling there?
It's got very bad quite quickly in the last few weeks, and I think the numbers are up. Sort of back beyond what they were during the first wave.
It's so horrible because we're so insulated here in our own panic that, like, you know, I fail to realize sometimes, like, you guys are really in the same thing.
Yes.
It's just, it's terrifying and people are dying every day.
It is. And I mean, with the various vaccinations that have been approved, there's hope, there's a bit of optimism that it, you know, there's some sense that it might end in the vaguely foreseeable future. But again, it's something that I'm not sure we'll be able to process exactly what it's done to Britain, exactly, you know, the massive failures that have come along with it. I think it's going to take years to, as you talk about, you know, what kind of society is going to emerge from this, you know, from the sort of selfish point of view of a, you know, working comedian. Are people going to want to go and sit in crowded rooms again? I think there's going to be a desire to do stuff that isn't sitting at home. But when will people feel comfortable being crowded into a confined space?
And also, people have become very adept at tuning in to these things. You know, like I'll do a live IG in the morning just to keep my brain sharp and engage with an audience in real time, which has helped. But I think, like what you're saying, if I think about it, like you're, you know, this idea that our brains want to know, it's sort of like, well, how are we going to reflect on this? And that's really the question a comic has to answer in terms of, you know, presenting it.
Yes.
So, I mean, that might give us both a little hope, because like in my brain, my biggest fear is that we're all going to see this as some sort of collective trauma. And because of PTSD, we're just going to, you know, sort of compartmentalize it into this haze that's like kind of a smear of a memory that a year or a year and a half, and kind of want to move past it. That's my fear.
Yes.
Is that we move past it and just sort of suppress it as a traumatic time without really contextualizing the impact, you know?
Yes. And I mean, particularly for, you know, having children who are, you know, at school age, it's the sort of defining, it'd probably be the defining time of their entire lives, really. It's, you know, it's going to shape their outlook, how they, you know, how they interact with life. And and comedically also, I think, I don't know what you think about this, Mark, what are people going to laugh at different things after, you know, when stand up restarts? How different is it going to be? What the impact that this has had, this huge kind of defining issue, but at the same time it's probably going to be something that people don't want to think about, don't want to be told about when they go to somewhere for escapism.
Well,
so I don't know how it's going to impact on that.
Well, I think we've established that we can start with farts no matter what.
There's always that.
There's the timelessness of flatulence and sex.
And
certainly flatulence and sex, reflecting on flatulence and sex during the pandemic will be rich with laughter.
Yes.
There's going to be family flatulence like never before. Difficulties in having sex, both with families not being able to leave the house and also dating time. Yeah,
yeah.
Lot, rich material with both of the timeless classics.
Yeah,
I think that like that kind of thing will be interesting. Like the honesty around that, because I do think that people are. I don't think that we're going to totally adapt to the intimacy of what you and I are doing here, that people are going to become so symbiotic with screens that, you know, the necessity to congregate will diminish. I don't think that's true. I think that people lose a great deal of themselves when they isolate, even if they're talking to people on screens. So I think that if it ever becomes safe again, people will want to congregate.
Yes. Oh, definitely. But I wonder, you know, I guess it'll be a process, wasn't it, of almost kind of relaxing back into it. And
yeah, I don't know how you relax. I did a movie, dude, and everyone. I did a movie for 12 days, and everybody's wearing masks with COVID protocol. But I got to be honest with you, once I surrendered to the idea that, like, this is as safe as it's going to be. You know, we're getting tested every other day, and everyone's wearing masks all the time, except when we have to act. And I was fucking thrilled to be, you know, in a collaborative effort in real time with living people.
Yes.
I mean, it was like, thank God, you know, I'm sane again for a minute.
Is there going to be an eruption of sort of, you know, communal activities, of, you know, artistic expression, almost like, you know, the kind of post-war booms of people just, you know, wanting to do anything?
I hope so. That would be encouraging. I want to think that a lot of people, especially visual artists and stuff, are who generally work in an isolated way anyways, like your father might have, are really kind of doing exciting things now. But I think people are so freaked out that most people are just paralyzed and not doing anything but watching television in their sweatpants.
I've got through a lot of pairs of sweatpants in the last year and a bit.
But I don't know. But like, in, you know, given that, you know, you spent your early life studying this sort of arc of of civilizations. I mean, and even with Brexit or whatever's happening with COVID, how do you frame this in your head? I mean, are you like somebody who's like, well, this is going to pass and the species will probably persist? Or how are you? You don't seem like an existentially fraught person to me.
No, probably not. I mean, I think, well, it clearly is going to pass in the way that, you know, plagues have passed. Now, you know, plagues in the ancient world that were, you know, fairly, well, kind of traumatic and shaping experiences. But, yeah, I don't know. I veer between wild pessimism and wild optimism. And
yeah.
I guess and a lot of it is thinking about the world that my kids are going to grow up in and the kind of lives they'll be able to lead, the education they'll be able to have, and, you know, what kind of jobs are going to, with all these different impacts on life, whether, you know, Brexit, COVID, the environment, just the general changings of the world. The sort of picture that I had of the world that they would enter when they depart childhood, it's changed. I can't really imagine, even in 10 years' time, what they will be dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's the most difficult thing for anybody. I don't have kids, so mine's in the realm of selfishness. Like, my head, I'm like, I'm 57, I've done okay, all right, maybe I'm done. But like when you have children, as many of my friends do, I think that, you know, is challenging for you as a person, as a father, and, you know, somebody who wants the best for their children. But also, just no matter who you are, there's no personal status quo anymore. Everything has been sort of blown up. You know, everything has been, you know, shattered. So we're all looking into this darkness without any real footing. And I think that the anxiety of that is overwhelming. But I do think, like you're saying, I think that's the most honest way to look at it is that we just don't know. And
yes,
it's really difficult that you can't even rely on, like, well, I can always go to the place. No, you can't, because it's closed. It's gone.
Yeah.
But are they going to? I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, this is the time of greatest human ignorance of my lifetime in terms of people kind of knowing what's going on currently and what is going to emerge. So it's, you know, as you say, cosmically unsettling. And, you know, some things might emerge largely unchanged, other things will be vastly different, and some things will just end. So
but again not farting and fucking. Farting and fucking are going to persist.
Yeah, death, taxes, farting, and fucking. Those are the big four. Never go away.
Is your wife in politics?
She's not. She was a criminal lawyer, a criminal advocate, and is currently, she's got a doctorate studying how young people are dealt with by the judicial system, and is currently writing a book about it. So, she has slightly more serious existence than I do, talking nonsense and thinking about cricket.
Well, yeah, but that's good. Like, it's so, that's the other hard thing about, like, and I, when I talk to creative people who are in the middle of working on things, they're like, does this even matter? Are we just, you know, animating the death throes of a civilization?
Well, possibly, but, you know, death throes are always fascinating, aren't they? But when I started out in stand-up, we've been together since university, as I said, and she was starting out around about the same time on the legal circuit, and you know, it's a different type of performing. There were certain similarities of being a criminal advocate in Britain. Where you're
She was a trial lawyer.
Basically? So she was. It's similar. You're sort of self-employed. You go from gig to gig, and but the difference would being that I'd be delighted if I'd written an amusing pun about fruit, and she was doing cases involving, frankly, horrific crimes. So it was kind of similar but different.
Yeah, 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 I could see your sort of enthusiasm at the end of the day when you're discussing your days kind of fading in light of her achievements.
Yes.
But wait, this punchline, this tag is great. You just got to like...
Yes, and you know, if I had a bad day at work, then I'd be slightly humiliated and embarrassed. And if she had a bad day at work, someone would go to jail, I guess. So it's, yeah.
You got to decide whether or not you're going to stick with that bit, or if it needs something else. And she's got to live with the fact that somehow or another, someone's going to spend their life in prison. Yeah, I mean, these are the lives we've chosen.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think I was cut out for real life, to be honest.
but sports, I mean, like, I don't know. I'm not a sports guy, and it seems that people who like sports, at least that gives you... That is something to live for, you know?
Yes, and it's, you know, everyone, you know, finds their escapism in different forms. I just love sport from when I was about 6 years old, and it's... It's, you know, something that's throughout my life been something where I can, you know, just escape from whatever I'm doing, and whether it's, you know, playing it at a very low level or watching it. And I started writing about cricket via the Bugle, actually. I talked about cricket on the Bugle because we always had quite a big American audience. So I would, you know, try and do as much cricket stuff as possible to goad America for not having taken the greatest thing ever.
To honor that original Zaltzman manifesto of alienating as many of the audience as possible.
Yeah.
You know, without getting any real foothold in success.
Yeah, that's good. Why change a losing formula? And so I ended up sort of getting to write about cricket for a cricket website, and then doing being part of the BBC's radio coverage. And well, particularly last year, it was this sort of incredible escape from everything else. And
thank God they kept playing, I guess, huh?
Yeah. And the players were all in bubbles, staying in hotels on the grounds, and the media were staying in different parts of the
Are they still doing it?
Around the world there's, you know, it's cricket bubbles going on. England's just gone out to Sri Lanka, there's Australia and India are playing, and it's a sport that, you know, the longest form of cricket, the games last up to 5 days, and it becomes almost meditative when you sit and watch an entire 5 day match, and, you know, quite a lot of them end in a draw, and it puts you on a, it's almost a sort of spiritual escapism from
that's great,
from everything. So I would heartily recommend it, Mark.
Yeah, I don't have many good escapes. Yeah, I'm painfully stuck in the, you know, my imagination is just fueled by dread. And, you know, occasional glimmers of hope and fantasy.
Yes.
But I'm not a science fiction guy. I like music. But are you a science fiction guy as well?
Not really. My daughter, who's just about to turn 14, she's got really into it. And she's now started writing. So I'll just go up to her bedroom and I'll say, oh, what are you doing? She said, oh, I'm just writing this science fiction story. So I've started to try and, you know, get a bit more into that. But
what's his son up to? What's his interest?
Well, he's quite into sports and maths, they're coping pretty well. It's very difficult. I can't quite imagine how I'd have dealt with this. I guess children are quite flexible, aren't they? I mean, they do adapt to what is presented to them, but
yeah, they'll adapt.
It's,
you know, they're their own little people, I guess, after a certain point.
Yeah, it's been my daughter was 7 when she turned to me at dinner and said, "Daddy, I think I'm getting too old for your jokes now." And that was a real moment. So, you know, those landmarks in parenting when, you know, you realise your children are becoming more independent. That 7 years old.
Wow. Well, outside of the Bugle, which is topical, and the cricket, is sort of, you know, up to date. You got to stay on top of that. But you're not really, I mean, I can't even begin to frame a future set at this juncture. But, you know, for somebody who thinks in terms of, you know, hour-long presentations, have you begun to think about that?
No, not really. I do, the last 4 years before, so from 2016 to 2019, I did an end of year review show, just sort of my main stand up of the year, when I'd try and put the event, the world of that year into an hour of of stand up. But I didn't do that this year, and so it's been a long time since I really sat down and tried to plan out a stand-up show. And I was thinking about it a couple of weeks ago, because I realised that basically I'd done 4 gigs in 2020, and they were all in January. Right. And I thought, well, what would I do if I had to do a gig now? What would I? And I couldn't remember how I used to start a stand-up set, or I couldn't remember. I mean, I've got them all written down, but because I write stuff every week for the Bugle, and most of the stuff, as you say, that I do is topical, whether it's for the Bugle or radio shows. I'm constantly churning over material, but not necessarily sort of honing it into lasting stand-up. And I'm in a slight panic that I thought I've got no idea how I would do a stand-up gig now. And having been doing it for over 20 years, that was slightly frightening. It's I do podcasts and radio and cricket, so stand-up is not what I rely on. But as a comedian,
you always got that muscle working.
Yes.
I was doing 3 sets, 4 sets a week, no matter what, just to stay frosty.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. There's definitely going to be, does pre-COVID material matter anymore? And,
yes.
We don't know what post-COVID's going to look like, but we all know what the fuck we're living with. And the one thing about it is there is a certain, this is one of the few times in history where we all have something very specific and very fucking prominent in common. There, we can all talk about how we handled this, how much cooking we did, how much eating we did, how much jerking off we did, how much yelling at our kids we did. I mean, there are going to be diaries of COVID, but I sadly, from day to day, I would imagine the patterns reveal itself, and it's one long day,
Yes. And also, and doing sort of political, topical comedy, a lot of what I've done in the last 4 years has been about Brexit and its impact on British politics, and globally on Trump and America, and what Trumpism stands for around the world. And those two things are going as well. So, what I've no idea what I would, someone said, you got to do an hour-long stand-up show in a month's time, I think I would really struggle, I think, to know what to do. And I guess a genuine deadline is always a great motivator, Mark. So
sure.
I guess I'll have to wait until that does.
Yeah, I think we'll snap into shape pretty good. I mean, one thing I've been noticing about Trumpism and fascism in general is that people who can't leave their houses or are unemployed are generally going to fuel that movement. that there's economic desperation and there's a lack of work and a lot of time to go down whatever rabbit hole your brain is going to go down to make your anger feel better. And sadly, a lot of times that ends with excluding people and possibly genocide. So.
And also, the internet is, there are infinite rabbit holes on the internet. And
the worst.
You
can find your people.
You can, or in my case, you can find black and white early footage of sport from the 1920s. But there's rabbit holes for everyone. There's a universe of rabbit holes.
Yes,
and
we're finding that. It's nobody needs to have the same experience ever again. I guess we'll find out, Andy. I think that if we do get a reprieve and we do get the ability to once again enter the world, that we will be so excited. We will find plenty of things to say.
Right. And will you come back to Edinburgh? The emotional Mark Maron return to Edinburgh.
I will not.
If there's one good to come out of COVID, Mark, surely it can be that. Come back to the fringe.
I will come back to the dingy damp room. I can't. I will come back to London. I will never go to the Gilded Balloon again. I just have no idea about that world. But I did have I did do a couple of dates in London over the last few years, in Birmingham and where else did I go? I did three dates, but I had a nice time. Manchester, I think.
Yeah.
In London, Birmingham, Manchester. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That does make sense. I remember speaking to you that year in Edinburgh, because I was doing my political animal show that you did in a room in sort of an old kind of underground passageways.
Right, it was a long thin room, narrow room with bricks, a lot of bricks.
It was a kind of classic Edinburgh room that it was completely not designed for stand-up, but it had a certain atmosphere.
I think it was damp.
Very damp. Yeah, the humidity in that room was... it was the kind of room you felt that someone probably died in it about 200 years ago.
Or there was butchering done. There was real work on anvils or with knives.
Yes. Yeah. Those walls would have stories to tell. I can't. What year was that?
Must have been 2006, maybe.
Yeah. So that was the year that John went to do the Daily Show. So I think I was. Then again, we were supposed to be co-hosting that show.
Oh, we were both shattered then. We were both struggling.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will say this. Maybe I will come and we'll hang out in Edinburgh again. If not, let's hang out next time I come to London, if that's ever possible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that would be great.
Good talking to you, man.
You too.
Okay, that's it. Andy Zaltzman, as I said earlier, he's got the podcast, The Bugle, where you can get wherever you get podcasts. You can hear him on the news quiz on BBC Radio 4. Enjoy the relief while we can. And I'll try to muster up a little hope. I've been meditating and I've been yoga-ing. And I've been working out and I've been trying to keep my sanity. I've been hiking up COVID Hill. But relief and okay, hope. Hope that we stabilize this fucking thing and hope that we get everybody vaccinated and some structure and organization begins to occur on a federal level. And also that, I'd like to be proud of my country again. I really would. I'll play some guitar for you now. Angels everywhere. Thank God for new management.